Hello, everyone. I feel like this is such a treat because I'm seeing so many familiar faces. So I have to say hello to Donna, of course, with big thanks for organizing this. And I just lost my gallery view. I've got to go back to that so I can see you all. There we go. There's Denise and Carol and Susie. Hi, everyone. Elise, Payment, Karen, Giovanna, Rosemary, David. Hi, everybody. So for those of you who maybe are tuning in on YouTube, my name is Tubten Chuing, or a lot of people might still think of me as Sarah. And I'm here tonight to do a little talk on creative mindfulness. So just to kind of give you a feeling for what the talk is going to be hopefully like, this is a beginning level talk about mindfulness and creativity. You don't have to be Buddhist for this. It's aimed at people who are both Buddhist or not Buddhist. But it's also going to examine how mindfulness came about with its roots and what does it mean, and how can we make sure that our mindfulness is authentic. And so before we actually get into the bulk of the talk, let's just start by setting our motivation. And so we can just take a minute to think about how wonderful it is that we have this technology, that we can be together today no matter where we are in the world. And we can think about how we want to develop a good heart, a loving attitude in every action that we do. And as we think about how do we cultivate this mindfulness that is a tool to allow us to do this, may it inspire us to utilize this mindfulness in every aspect of our daily life so that we can become the best possible human being and be kind to all sentient beings. So the question, of course, that we're starting with is basically, what is mindfulness? And the reason why it's important to ask this question when we start is because we need to be very clear that we're talking about the same thing, because mindfulness has been used in so many different ways. As it has been exported from Buddhism and its sort of original culture, it now gets used in TV shows and commercials and corporations and Google Talks and TED Talks. And so it's all over the place without necessarily meaning the same thing to everyone. And one thing that I hear a lot is that mindfulness is just be in the now, be present. And so that's one very common perception of mindfulness. Sometimes I hear that mindfulness is stopping thoughts, trying to completely quiet your mind and stop all the thoughts. And both of these things are a little bit of a misconception if they're not really understood. So being present here in the now, yes, that's part of an aspect of mindfulness, is trying to really be completely in tune with whatever is happening in the present moment and seeing reality, how it truly exists in that moment, and not letting our mind run away with all kinds of anxieties about what the future is and all this guilt and heaviness from the past. But that's not the whole story, for sure. And stopping thoughts isn't quite right either. Our precious teacher at Kadampa Center, Geshe Gelug, says that if we think that it's just stopping thoughts, then that's called chicken meditation, because the chickens will sit there on one leg and their eyes will go glassy and it looks like they have no thoughts going on. And that's not what we're trying to go for either. We're not trying to just empty our mind and zone out. Really, when we're talking about mindfulness, there's two aspects to it. So the first aspect is that we're trying to develop the ability to hold our attention on our chosen object. So there's this aspect of concentration. And that may include, as we develop the practice, if we're doing it in meditation, then we have one object and we're trying to learn to focus on it. But if you think about in your daily life, you know, you're taking in a lot of objects with your senses. And you're trying to learn to be present with everything that's happening in a moment to you, which when you really think about it, is extraordinary how much mindfulness it would take to really be present with everything happening in even one moment of our daily activities. And this is the ability to hold that focus and not let any distractions pull us away from it. So it's sort of like the antithesis of multitasking, where we're sort of bouncing between, we've got our headphones on and we're listening to some music and we're trying to type something and we're watching the texts on our phone and we're having a drink with our other hand. Really, it's about being much more present and not letting our mind jump around from thing to thing to thing to thing. But more importantly, the second half of mindfulness is that it needs to be grounded in ethics. So B. Alan Wallace, who's an amazing teacher, meditation practitioner, did a lot of research into the original Sanskrit teachings on mindfulness and all these translations and trying to get a hold for 20 years on what mindfulness means. And even he says, I'm not going to give you one definition for mindfulness because it wouldn't give it justice because it is used in different contexts. But one thing is very clear as we look at how mindfulness is being used in the West, that if it loses this grounding in ethics, then it is no longer authentic mindfulness. So what does that mean? It has to have this virtue to it. So as Venerable Ravina Corton always says, mindfulness can be practiced by a thief. This is a very classic example in the Buddhist text. So if you are a thief, you have to be completely aware of your surroundings so that you're not caught off guard or caught in the act. You have to have total concentration on what you're doing if you're trying to, say, pick a lock or crack a safe, despite what other stresses might be happening around you, any worries you might be having. But there's no virtue in that. So that is a type of concentration, but not the kind of concentration we're trying to develop. So one of the great teachers in the Tibetan Buddhist Gelugpa tradition, Lama Tsongkhapa, he talks about the six perfections in this text called the Middle Length Lam Rim, and says that mindfulness, which is developing calm abiding, is developing concentration that is able to establish the mind in virtue. And so that's interesting. That just even in that definition, it's really very clear that we are trying to direct the mind to all things virtuous and eliminate all things non-virtuous. But in addition to that, I asked my teacher in New Zealand, Geshe Wangchen, who is the resident teacher of Dorje Chang Institute in Auckland. I was trying to, get my head wrapped around what is mindfulness for this very reason of it's thrown around in so many ways. And I really pressed him and said, Geshe, what is the point of mindfulness? Why are we doing it? If you could sum it up in one thing, what's the point? And he said, to realize reality. So, this really is what we're trying to do, is we're trying to get rid of these exaggerations and attachments and elaborations that we're putting onto reality. And this is what's tied to that non-virtue, right? If we're eliminating these things, then we're actually naturally going towards virtue. We're naturally going to love and compassion, our natural state of mind. And when Venerable Ravina talks about this, she talks about in Buddhist practice, that typically means that once we've developed this type of concentration, then we're pairing this concentration, which is rooted in virtue, with either understanding impermanence, very subtle impermanence, the changing nature of how everything that functions is changing moment to moment, or we use it to be paired with meditating on emptiness, so trying to realize emptiness. So that may be a little bit of Buddhist jargon that anyone who's watching is not going to quite understand, but that's okay. We're just, again, trying to give an introduction to what are these roots of mindfulness and how is it used in a very authentic context. And this is coming out of an incredible tradition in India of thousands of years of people meditating and looking at their mind and what is the mind and how do I exist, how do phenomena exist, and so it's coming from this incredible scholastic and truly people living the practice and then trying to help us pass along those instructions. So continuing from what Lama Tsongkhapa was saying in the Middle Length Lam Rim, when he said that mindfulness is developing concentration that's able to establish the mind in virtue, he continues to, which is the fifth of the six perfections. Then the sixth is, when the mind is in meditative equipoise, you will have the realization of reality just as it is. And here's where Geshe Wangchen got us to the end point, the end of the six perfections, which is we're trying to use mindfulness to see reality, how it really exists. So then we have to ask, well, how do we practice it? And of course, classically, when we think of mindfulness, we're thinking of meditation, where you sit down on a cushion in a very special posture with your back straight and maybe your legs crossed, or in a chair and you focus on the breath. And you're trying to develop that concentration on the object, which is the breath. And then there are many variations to carry on from that, like meditating on the body in order to understand impermanence, using it to pair with meditation on emptiness. And as I said, if you don't understand these terms, don't worry. There are other ways that this will make sense to you. But that's, again, not really the whole story of mindfulness. Really, mindfulness is something we're supposed to be cultivating 24/7, all the time. Which is sort of like, oops, why did it take me so long to realize that? And again, I've heard many teachers tell me that their students, even some of the really old students, will say to them, Geshe-la, I don't have time to sit on a cushion and do my meditation practice. And I think if there was a culture of doing a face palm in Tibetan Buddhism, that would be the response we would get, because we're really missing the point that we're supposed to be doing it all the time. This is the meditation is, yes, we have to develop concentration sitting on a cushion, that there's a lot of benefits to that. And if we're really going to do it as a lifetime practice, we have to incorporate that. But the session doesn't just end when you get up off the cushion. You have to continue it in whatever you are doing. And what I found really interesting was that, you know, those of us who are involved in any kind of activity where we are used to being very focused. So I'm going to talk about it from the creative aspect because I've, you know, studied art and practiced photography and tried to merge that with my mindfulness practice. But it applies to other activities too. So anyone who's had that experience of being very focused on an activity that you're doing, in the creative community, it's called flow, right? You get into this incredibly calm, really just you're there with what you're doing. In terms of creating art, you've let go of this. You may have had a general idea of what you were trying to create, but you've let go of the control of it because at least what I found in artistic pursuits is whatever happens is not necessarily what you set out to have happen. If you're painting, the paint just doesn't do exactly what you had in mind. If you're trying to take a photograph, there's something in it that isn't exactly how you would have had it. You know, so there's always an interplay of whatever it is you're doing and whatever it is you're creating, and you've let go of the control of trying to force it to be what you wanted. If you're trying to force it to be what you want, then you've got a very sort of narrow, stressful mind. But when you're in this flow state, you've really let go of that, and you're just there with it, letting it evolve. And it's very relaxing. And, you know, when we think about this, if you've ever experienced it, it's really lovely. And you might then think to yourself, well, gosh, my meditation on the cushion isn't anything like that. So, you know, that's something to consider is, you know, this is the kind of state of mind that we are trying to develop in our meditation and our activities that's very focused, but also very relaxed. And Geshe Tarchin, when he was teaching on middle length Lam Rim by Lama Tsongkhapa, and he was another one of my teachers in New Zealand, was saying that any type of daily activity that we do where we get into this kind of flow state is simulated calm abiding. So if we're getting very familiar with this kind of very focused, very relaxed mind state in our daily activities, we're getting a little taste of what it's like, just a little taste, because it's only simulated calm abiding. We're getting a little taste of what the end result would be if we do this practice continuously in all our aspects and really learn the practice correctly, get guidance how to do the practice. And so that's actually, to me, really encouraging that, you know, there's something I'm already very familiar with, and it's a stepping stone in this process. So that's very nice to think about. But then there's this other aspect of being really aware of what's happening in our mind. So if we go back to our original understanding of what mindfulness is, so we have this concentration, this flow, which has this very, it brings a very relaxed feeling, which, by the way, is just a side effect, right? It's not the end goal. So we're not just trying to relax either. That's another common misconception with meditation, that you're just there to feel good. Whereas if that's your goal, you're going to give up pretty quickly because, you know, meditation has good days and bad days. And that is completely normal. and for years and years and years, that's going to continue to be very normal, whereas sometimes good and sometimes not good. So the relaxation that comes from this type of meditation, that comes from the flow in the work that you're doing, it is the side effect but not the end goal of mindfulness meditation. So we have to be very aware of the thoughts that are happening in our mind. When we have a very strong sense of the self, when we have a strong sense of the I, when we have a lot of attachments, when we have any negative states of mind, when we're trying to either meditate or do our daily activities, then it is distracting. It disturbs the mind. And the stronger the eye, the stronger those delusions are, the more distracted, the more disturbed our mind is going to be. So when we talk about a strong sort of sense of ego, sort of like if we're talking about, say, our creative pursuit like photography, you know, I'm going to get the best shot, right? I'm going to put this on Facebook. I'm going to get lots of likes, you know, so that really strong sense of I, or you're in my way. I want to take a picture here. Or if we have the same thing with attachment of, you know, I really want this picture. I really want it to be this way. You know, this attachment of really that control again of wanting it to be something that isn't necessarily what reality is, and thinking that it's got much more positive attributes than it actually does, the object appearing much more attractive than it actually is, and then you're wanting to have it. And I think, you know, I find in my own experience at least that when these delusions, when this strong sense of ego is really roaring up, that's when we turn to distraction. That's when we want to put the earplugs in, earphones in, turn on the music. Yeah, we want to have the video playing on YouTube next to our work. You know, we're always looking for something to help, or eating while I'm doing it, because I'm trying to distract myself from these disturbing states of mind, this anxiety that's coming up in my mind. And if I have enough things to distract myself, then maybe it will make that feeling go away, right? And if we're doing that, we're just mixing in even more delusions. We're just making ourselves even more distracted, more disturbed. It might shift the feeling, but it's in the long run, it's not very helpful. It's much more helpful to learn how to be aware of the inner thoughts, of questioning them. Are they really true? And learning not to listen to the ones that aren't telling you the truth. And when the thoughts are coming, if we're much more comfortable with our thoughts, then even if they're thoughts we don't agree with, they will pass quite quickly. They won't agitate as much. They won't cause that anxiety that makes you feel like you have to distract yourself. And this is a long process of really being able to see not just a surface level of the inner thoughts, because that's pretty much where we are on our day-to-day activities. You know, we're only hearing the really gross, really obvious thoughts. We'll be aware of those, but we're not aware of the whole story underneath them. We're not aware of our motivation, really, most of the time. And so using mindfulness, we're getting really in touch with our motivation. And if it's positive, then we're encouraging it. And if it's a delusion, if it's a disturbing state of mind, we're learning not to believe it, buy into it, give it energy, follow it. And so this is where we come back to those ethics. When we have an underlying motivation, of a positive state of mind, then the mind is not disturbed. Just very naturally. And if we find ourselves disturbed, we're going to find down at that really deep level that the motivation is wrong. We are often mistaken about what our motivation is. We're very good at rationalizing things, right? Yeah. You know, when you want that piece of cake, it's very good, very easy to rationalize why you should have it, right? So we are telling ourselves many lies about what our motivation actually is. And when we can really calm our mind down and get in touch with what is the whole story, then we start to see more clearly what our motivations are. And that's not always a comfortable place to be. So we have to learn to also be very comfortable with uncomfortable places in our mind. I find that, we have this sort of persona that we like to present to people. But inside, if you're looking deep enough, there's often a dissonance. There's something that's happening in you that you don't really want others to see, you know, that you really wouldn't admit it to anybody. You know, you wouldn't tell anybody what your actual thoughts are out loud. That's a good test, right? If you would actually say everything you're thinking out loud, then there's probably no dissonance. But if there's something in you that you really wouldn't let come out of your mouth, then, you know, these are these uncomfortable places that we find when we start to go deeper. And so we have to be very brave about this. So we can't be too attached to always feeling good. Like if we're just doing this because we always want to feel good and not ever have uncomfortable feelings, we're leading ourselves down a path, again, that is unattainable. And we're, in a way, shooting ourselves in the foot, so to speak. You know, we're going the absolute opposite direction of actually achieving a state that is always pleasurable. It's very ironic, really. So we have to be ready to be uncomfortable and accepting of being uncomfortable and very compassionate towards ourselves as we go into this mindfulness practice and seeing these underlying motivations that we have. And so our spiritual director, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, really emphasizes what are called the eight worldly dharmas, or the eight worldly concerns, which is a really incredible way of taking everything that we do that has a wrong motivation and narrowing it down to just four things, which is really astonishing if you think about it. And if you test it out, you know, I challenge you, if you have a wrong motivation, to find that it doesn't fit in one of these four. And I say four, even though it's the eight worldly concerns, because it's really just four things and it's the flip side of each. So it's four times two. So we have gain and loss. Am I doing this for just profit, to get something for myself? And the flip side being avoiding losing things. We have pleasure and pain. As I've said, you've got to be really brave to go down into your mind and look at what's happening there. So if you are only in it for pleasure, when the difficult things come up, you're going to avoid them. Back to distraction, put the headphones in, let me turn on the music. You know, I don't want to go there. And then there's the flip side of pain, wanting to avoid anything that's painful. So just wanting things to feel good, wanting to avoid anything that doesn't feel good. And that also applies to physical things. you know, so like sitting in meditation on your cushion, if you are going to try that practice of, you know, may get rather uncomfortable very quickly, and you can give up really easily if you are very attached to avoiding any pain whatsoever. Whereas, and if you're very attached to pleasure, you know, well, you know, it would feel a lot more good right now if I went to eat breakfast. So we have to learn to start to go beyond sort of these immediate cravings and aversions. We have fame and disgrace, which go very closely in hand with their partners, blame and disgrace. So these are the other two. And so here we're getting into, will people like me? What's going to happen to my reputation if I do this? Will I get the likes on Facebook? Will somebody post a nasty comment? And blame, you know, if I make a mistake, is anybody going to notice? Trying to get people to like us, to avoid people saying anything negative about us, to get credit for the things that we're doing right and avoid anybody seeing anything that we do wrong. All of these motivations are going to lead to disappointment and disturbing mind states. And so we use this mindfulness practice to start seeing underneath the obvious level of our chatter in our mind, which may be telling us one thing, and we're getting down deep enough that we can see, hey, is one of my motivations one of these four, one of these eight worldly concerns? Am I really being honest with myself about why I'm doing this? And if it is motivated by one of these eight worldly concerns, which if you're like me is pretty much all of the time, then mindfulness is about training ourselves to think differently using a positive motivation. And at first it's very forced. You know, we have old habits of being motivated by these worldly concerns. And so we kind of try and change that and think more positively, but very quickly that disappears. So it takes a lot of effort at first, but then the more that you do it, the more easily that it comes. This is another one of Lama Tsongkhapa's famous quotes, is everything becomes easier with familiarity. The more that we do it, the easier it gets. So right now we're pretty familiar with things that are leading us to suffering. Now we're trying to shift it and lead ourselves in a new direction that is actually much more reliable in terms of bringing us to the happy state of mind that we're actually looking for. So how does this apply to, say, our creative activities in daily life? So I'm going to use, again, photography as an example of sort of what can we do with mindfulness and ethics in developing our daily activities. So the first thing that I might want to check when I'm doing photography is, am I harming self or others? This is basic level of virtue here. So harming self, well, it's such a phenomenon now that people are dying by accident by taking selfies, that there's a word for it. It's called selfie-cide, right? It is so common. I'm not making this up, right? Check it up on the omniscient Google that, you know, if you're risking your life for a selfie, harming yourself for a photo, then your ethics are way out of whack. If you've pulled your car over in a very hazardous place just because you want to get a photo of that view, where either you might get hit by a car or someone might hit your car and get hurt, then there's a problem with that motivation. Are you mocking someone with your photography? Making fun of them? And what I think is really interesting is it stopping you from helping someone? And one lovely example is there was a pretty big controversy over some documentary filmmakers who were working on the David Attenborough series Dynasties, because they were filming some penguins that had gotten trapped in a gully. And the typical philosophy of documentary filmmaking is non-intervention. So if there's a sentient being that's going to die, you just let it die. But these filmmakers decided they were going to help the penguins. And so they made a little escape route so that the penguins could get out if they wanted to. So they didn't actually go take the penguins out, but they just gave them a chance. And there were very divided opinions about this. But from an ethical point of view, of simply, there were sentient beings there, they could do something to help them. It wasn't going to harm other animals to do that. They really looked inside them and said, I want to help these beings. And these aren't easy answers, but just to give you a taste of sort of the way that you would use mindfulness as you're out with your camera, if you're a photographer or in any creative activity, is looking at, you know, is this beneficial for everyone involved? I've got to do my best not to harm myself and not to harm others. Similarly, if you're shooting, say, in a national park, and they put up signs that say, please don't go off the trails. Maybe there are endangered plants and animals that you will be killing if you go off the path, but there's that irresistible view. And if you go off the path, you'll have a picture that no one else has, right? Attachment will tell you it's worth it. Virtue will tell you don't harm others to get what you want. And then, you know, again, we've touched on this a little bit, but what's the motivation for this photo? You know, am I taking this photo because I want attention? Right? I want to post this on social media. I want people to notice me, pay attention to me, like me, praise me. There's another one of those eight worldly concerns. Am I doing it out of competition, wanting to be better than everybody else? There's this famous tree in New Zealand on the South Island called the Wanaka tree. And it's a point of pride of photographers. They just flocked there all the time to try and take a picture of this tree that was somehow better than the picture that everybody else took. And it became this just constant competition. And it's so well known that it just says, I went to that tree, right? And I think unfortunately, someone was so negatively affected by all this competition, they went and they actually cut off the main branch of the tree so that now it's no longer as beautiful and that view is ruined. And I think all of this came out of that spirit of competition, of everybody trying to top each other, of fighting for the right view, of, you know, there was always fighting there of people getting in each other's way and, you know, trying to beat each other out on the view. Yeah, so competition. Or is your motivation positive? Is it virtuous? Is it maybe just to bring joy to people? Is it to raise awareness so that people can be helped who need help? So there are many beneficial reasons for taking the photo. And you find that if you're based in the beneficial ones, then the mind is not disturbed the way that it is when it's based in these worldly concerns. Questions like, are you exploiting anyone? This is really difficult with street photography. You know, are you taking pictures of someone who doesn't want their picture taken? Is that picture going to be used to make a meme that's really embarrassing for that person? A really kind of tricky question that has come up is, when we post photos of our own children, you know, those kids can't give you informed consent. And those photos can, you know, once they go out on the internet, they can be there permanently. You know, so when they're 18, 20, do they really want something that can be shared on the internet with anybody and everybody of when they were two? You know, it's different than when you had the photo album and the only time people saw the embarrassing pictures was when your date came home for prom, right? Then you could go, oh, mom, dad. But it's different with the internet, you know? The kids don't really have a say, so that's a pretty big question. And in the way that you present your photos, are you misleading and disturbing people? You know, if you're altering the content of your photo, is it simply to make it more attractive, or is it actually misleading people about the content and for what reason? You know, photoshopping, so to speak, has been around since the very beginning of photography. You know, you it's not something that's unique to computers. From the very earliest photographers, they were changing the actual prints to take people out of them, put people in who weren't there, change the background, all that could be done. And so, you know, questioning what's happening when we do that. I saw a really a disturbing post about they were photographs of the Olympic athletes being caught in really awkward, embarrassing moments. So, you know, with all the photographers who are trying to get a shot during the Olympics, you're going to catch all kinds of moments of people unaware and doing things that if they knew their photo was being taken, they wouldn't do. And it includes, you know, wardrobe malfunctions where things are showing that shouldn't be showing, you know. And now these the people who were in that event to try and be the best sportsmen possible are being embarrassed by, you know, having been in that competition. Yeah. And for clickbait, you know, so that you can get money from advertisers by getting people to click on it. And then there's also a lot of ethical discussion about when we're doing photography of, are we preserving the dignity of the person that we're taking the picture of? And this is a big question for journalists who are taking picture of people in disasters, people in poverty, people with disabilities, that a lot of times in order to get the most dramatic photo, we're maybe distorting so that the person appears in a much worse situation than they actually are. There was one example in an article I was reading where they had two pictures side by side of a man. On one side, he was on top of a rubbish pile, squatting down in kind of dirty clothes. And in the other, he's in a suit and happy, smiling. And both same man, you know, but the poverty one was to try and tug at your heartstrings and, you know, get you to feel like he's this impoverished man in a difficult situation, when in actuality, he was also a very successful businessman. You know, had a lot of things that he would be proud of. And by if you choose to use the picture of him looking impoverished, you're not really telling his whole story and respecting what he has accomplished. So all of these questions, you know, it rarely are we examining what we're doing that deeply. So as we get in touch with this motivation and trying to make it more ethical, of course, we want to always think, you know, first level of practice is not harming others. That's like the baby steps. That's step number one. As we work our way up to more opening our heart more, of respecting people more, loving people more, and animals and all sentient beings, it's leading us to this development of a mind state called bodhicitta. And this is what we really want to practice thinking about as our motivation. And again, this isn't going to come naturally. This is something where first we have to intellectually just start thinking, oh, wait, my motivation wasn't really great here. How could I approach this from the point of view of being of benefit to all sentient beings? And you can have a lot of fun with this. I mean, this should be fun for you. I find it terribly fun. And if you can have fun with this sort of thing, then you're going to find a lot of joy in your practice, and it's going to come much more easily. So it can be uncomfortable to see when your motivation is not right. But then when you have this fun, it's sort of, okay, how could I do this from a bodhicitta motivation? Then it becomes almost a game. And you can get very creative with it. So if you have that sort of creative side to you that you like to explore, this is a great way to do it. So from the Buddhist point of view, bodhicitta does have a very specific definition of completing the two collections of bodhicitta to become enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings. So we're aiming for a mind state of enlightenment, which is just a perfection of all of our positive qualities and eliminating all the negative ones. And we want to do that so that we can help all other sentient beings without exception attain that state too. We become qualified. We know what we're talking about. I haven't got it, so I don't know what I'm talking about most of the time. But if I get it, then I can actually genuinely help people. but I think, you know, for anyone of any faith, you can simply still have that view of, may I be of benefit to all sentient beings? And it's really important to have all sentient beings as the basis of it. So again, as a beginner, we might just be, you know, focusing on the one or two sentient beings who are right in front of us. May I be of benefit to you? But then we work on trying to expand that to all sentient beings so that we are making sure that even though we're taking care of the main person in front of us, that we're not stepping off the path and crushing all the bugs that are to the left of the path, right? We're being very conscious of any sentient being that we might be affecting. And when we say sentient being, we're talking about, from the Buddhist point of view, any being that has a mind. Because any being that has a mind just wants to be happy, does not want to suffer. In Lamasa Rinpoche's book, The Bodhisattva Attitude, which is put out by Lama Yeshe Wisdom Archive, he has a whole section on examples of daily activities that we're doing and possible bodhicitta motivations. And they're a lot of fun. It helps if you have a lot of Buddhist vocabulary. but I pulled out a couple just that are easier to understand as we get the feel for what this means. So, you know, when we take off our belt at the end of the day, especially after you've had a big dinner, and if your belt, the elastic is stretched to the max, or, you know, it maybe doesn't have a lot of stretch, it feels really good to take that belt off. So usually we're just focused on the relief of taking the belt off, right? Very selfish motivation. And so if you thought, okay, well, how can I make this for all sentient beings? Rinpoche recommends you think, may sentient beings be freed from the bondage of karma and delusions. So as I free my waist, may I free all sentient beings from suffering. another one, and this is a very common example for starting on your mindfulness practice of how to utilize cleaning with a positive motivation, because we do so much cleaning every day, right? Cleaning the dishes, cleaning the floor, cleaning the clothes. So much cleaning has to be done. And there are many ways you can play with this. So Rinpoche recommends, may all sentient beings not engage in bad conduct. May they have perfect, beautiful, wonderful conduct. So thinking about like cleaning the minds of all sentient beings. You can also think, may I clean any negative state from my mind as I clean the floor. May I wipe away the stains of ignorance as I wipe away the dirt from my dishes. For the benefit of all sentient beings. And this is what I mean by it gets really fun if you play with it. So I've lived in conditions where there have been a lot of bugs. And so, you know, this bug, when it comes crawling across the table at me, our first reaction might be, ew, get that away from me. But if you're practicing shifting your motivation, notice it, don't believe it, and try and shift it and think, okay, well, this bug just wants me to be kind to it. So may I benefit this bug here and now? And then see what happens. And, you know, I get kind of goofy about these things, you know, so I think about what it, situations and sort of what if, right? So could you think of bodhicitta if you were swimming with a shark? So if we have a lot of ego and fear, then we're just swimming away as fast as we can, thinking, you know, get me away from this shark. But could we shift that? Could we be thinking, as we're still swimming away as fast as we can, may this shark be happy? And which, if you had those two thoughts, which do you think would make you happier? The shark's there either way, right? Nothing you can do about that. And this is the point, is that this practice, as silly as that sounds, is actually a way to make ourselves happy no matter what the situation. And so I encourage you to play with that, that this is our job, that we need to be looking at our motivation, seeing how do we make it positive. And then see what happens from that. See what happens to how you start to react in your everyday situations and how it changes your habits. So are there any questions? There is an opportunity if anyone would like. We have a couple minutes left, so I'm happy to answer any questions you might have. Susie, I see, has her hand up. Yeah?
I do a lot of hula hoop flow, and that involves movement.
Mm-hmm.
And if I really get into it, it just flows.
Mm-hmm.
So this could be done with movement?
Mm-hmm.
Too? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. So it starts with, before you even begin hula hooping, what is my motivation for hula hooping?
Yeah.
Right? And so then you...
That would help.
Yeah, you just look down and you sort of check it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, can I make it better? Can I incorporate either non-harming or benefiting others when I hula hoop?
Yeah, I could. I think that's an excellent thing to try. Thank you.
Mm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? It can be done with absolutely everything. It should be done with absolutely everything. And this is what Geshe Wangchen was saying about it's not just a practice for the cushion. Yeah, go ahead, Susie.
Sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
I've often thought that the motivation for bodhicitta motivation was to have us angle ourselves toward helping all sentient beings in our future lives. And I hadn't thought about the making ourselves happy no matter what part. Mm. So that was very nice to hear.
Mm.
But am I wrong with my first thought?
No, you're not wrong that we should be always thinking, may I attain enlightenment, which will probably take countless lifetimes, unless we're very along on the, far along on the path, which you might be. I can't tell where any of you are on the path. So for every lifetime, may I always stay focused on becoming enlightened for the benefit of all sentient beings, but may that also be my focus in everything that I do right now here, here now.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Anything else before we wrap up? Donna, no question on YouTube?
I just checked and there aren't any.
Okay, great. We don't want to miss anybody just in
case.
That's right. All right. So let's finish by doing what we call a dedication. And we talk about dedicating the merit. And what is merit? Well, merit is really just a... what you might call spiritual energy. It's just this positive energy that we've created by talking about how can we use this practice of meditation, of incorporating positive states of mind into all of our daily activities in a way that we are not harming other sentient beings, but and developing the capacity in order to do absolutely everything so that we are always benefiting all sentient beings. So may we dedicate all of that amazing positive energy helping us to actually accomplish that path. And in that way, may you and all sentient beings have happiness.
Thank you so much, Jingla.
Thank you.
That was really nice.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. I'm glad you could all be with me. Thank you for so many wonderful, smiling, lovely faces here with me today.
Thank you.
And I enjoyed the single eyebrow.
Thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Bye now.
Bye.
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 Thank you.